This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, diplomatic freeze. Can Australia and China repair a fractured relationship? And after coronavirus, our healthcare systems will never be the same again. So are virtual hospitals the future?
This entire pandemic has presented some opportunities for us to actually leverage off technology to connect to our patients and our community in ways that we've never been able to do before.
Tensions between the US and China continue to rise as America struggles with the impact of the coronavirus. China has accused the US of trying to smear and blame shift and says the United States should focus more on controlling the outbreak at home. As North America correspondent David Lipson reports, it comes after the President Donald Trump again suggested China may face consequences.
In mid-February, Donald Trump praised President Xi for China's transparency over the coronavirus. By early last week, though, he was threatening consequences.
If it was a mistake, a mistake is a mistake. But if they were knowingly responsible, yeah, then there should be consequences.
Now the US president says it's personal. Reuters reports Donald Trump saying Beijing will do anything they can to ensure he loses the election in November. The audio hasn't been released, but China's Ministry for Foreign Affairs responded sharply nonetheless. China, like the US, is a victim of the virus, said spokesman Gen Shuang. At this particular time, they should focus on domestic epidemic control and international anti-epidemic cooperation rather than attack, smear and shift the blame to China. In his interview, President Trump also suggested he could, quote, do a lot regarding consequences against China, but he didn't offer specifics. Australian diplomatic relations with China have also been tested in recent days over the push for an independent inquiry into the outbreak in Wuhan. China's talk of a potential consumer boycott in response was noted by US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
I saw comments from the Chinese Foreign Ministry talking about a coercive activity with respect to Australia, who had the temerity to ask for an investigation. Who in the world wouldn't want an investigation of how this happened to the world?
Former director of the US National Security Council, Robert Spalding, is now a China specialist at the Hudson Institute.
It's not a transparent government. It drives an obfuscation.
He says an investigation into China's role in the spread of the coronavirus is needed, but don't expect the Communist Party to play along.
The Chinese Communist Party is very good at hiding, you know, and their own prerogatives and their own reasons for making decisions. So I don't think that's going to change.
Mr. Spalding says America has changed and will take a very different approach to China no matter who wins the November election.
Coronavirus has actually galvanized the United States on both the left and the right that we need to make a change. And so, you know, whatever happens in 2020, I think you're going to see increased import enforcement on Chinese companies and on the Chinese in particular going forward.
So much so, both Donald Trump and his opponent, Joe Biden, are accusing the other of being soft on China. This is David Lipson in Washington for AM.
Well, the top US spy agency says the nation's intelligence community does not believe that coronavirus was man-made or genetically modified. That's come from the Office of Director of National Intelligence, although they're still trying to figure out if the pandemic began through contact with infected animals or at a laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Australia's push for an international inquiry into all of this has sparked an angry reaction from China's ambassador this week, with threats of a boycott by Chinese students and tourists, perhaps even shunning our wine and beef exports. Well, the Foreign Minister is Maurice Payne, and she joined me earlier. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Kim.
Does Australia agree with the conclusion from US intelligence agencies that coronavirus was not man-made or genetically modified?
I've seen the reports of that overnight, Kim, and we'll have a close look at those in the coming days. Obviously, we want to work very closely with the whole international community, and that's why we have initiated calls for an independent and transparent review of the coronavirus and of responses to it.
The US has backed Australia's push for an inquiry into the origins of this pandemic. How many other countries, though, are on board?
I think there is a very broad range of understanding that there is definitely a need for an independent and transparent review. And we have been very gratified by the engagement we've had in recent days and in the last week with the Prime Minister's calls and my own. What is important, though, and I mentioned this when I first talked about the review, is the timing. Many countries in the world are literally going into the challenges of the first wave for them of dealing with coronavirus. So we absolutely understand and have said from the beginning that the timing of this is important. But what we do need to do is to put that stake in the ground to say we need to have an independent and transparent review. And that's the process that we're
at the moment. When you talk about timing, Andrew Forrest told AM earlier this week that maybe it's got to be put off until after the US election, given the state of relations between the US and China. Is that a good idea?
I don't think that the timing of elections around the world is particularly relevant, to be frank. The World Health Organization, the World Health Assembly, for example, is meeting on the 18th of May. And that assembly will have before it a resolution from the European Union, which in part refers to the need for an appropriate review. And those things will be considered during the course of the coming months. And that is as I would expect it to be.
The relationship between Australia and China has been pretty dicey over the last couple of weeks. The Chinese ambassador's suggestion that Australia might face a consumer boycott for pushing this inquiry idea. The former foreign minister, Alexander Downer, says the diplomat's gone rogue. Your fellow Liberal MP, Trent Zimmerman, says that that boycott threat is downright despicable and menacing. Do you agree with those characterisations?
I think I've said earlier this week that we reject any suggestion that economic coercion would be an appropriate response to calls for an independent and transparent review, when what we actually need right now is global cooperation. And that is endorsed by many around the world. I even saw the UN Secretary General, for example, committing to looking back fully to understand how such a disease emerged and spread.
But my question was the characterisations by some people here in Australia, gone rogue, despicable, menacing. Do you agree that with those characterisations by Australian politicians?
Well, they're characterisations for them, Kim. They're not my characterisations. I've said that we work closely with the diplomatic community in Australia, but we do reject the approach that the ambassador took, which may be construed as economic coercion. That's not appropriate, and I've been very clear about that.
You're getting plenty of free advice. The media mogul Kerry Stokes reckons that if Beijing's anger isn't quelled, it could have catastrophic consequences for the economy. Are you risking Australia's biggest export market?
What we're actually guaranteeing is working in Australia's national interests, and I think Australians expect that of their government, and that's what this government is absolutely focused on. I don't think the business community in this country has a single monolithic view about these issues. Most people appreciate the need for a reasonable balance, and in protecting our national interests, we protect both our national security and our economy. That's the focus for the government. We will work with business, of course we will, and we will need to be pulling together internationally to ensure that we can come out of the other side of this with the economy going in the right direction and in the long-term interests of our nation.
Well, talking about working with business, do you regard the Chinese Consul General's appearance with Andrew Forrest at that event with the Health Minister Greg Hunt this week as a bit of an ambush?
Well, I understand that Mr. Forrest invited the Consul General to attend the media conference.
The government didn't know anything about it?
Well, Mr. Hunt has made his own comments about that. And, of course, I was not there.
Did you know about it?
No, I was not aware, and I would not expect to be aware of every colleague's media conference arrangements. But
does the government feel a bit blindsided by it?
Oh, no, I don't think so. The proper and courteous thing to do was to accept the gentleman's presence as a representative of the government invited by Mr. Forrest. Most importantly, though, I think the achievements that the government has been making in relation to ensuring we have the equipment and the supplies that we need. And I have to say that Mr. Hunt has been doing an exceptional job in ensuring that the PPE, the medical equipment that we need, is here in Australia for Australians.
The US President Donald Trump says he is considering several mechanisms to hold China accountable. Has the US shared with Australia what they might be?
Well, we speak regularly with our counterparts in the United States. As you know, the Prime Minister has spoken with the President recently. And this is the beginning of the conversation, Kim, I would say, not the end. There are a lot
But specifically, do you know what he's talking about?
Not in specifics. I understand the president and his administration will be examining the steps they think that they should take, and that is a matter for them. For Australia's part, I think the focus that we have on the need for an independent and transparent review at the international level, with members of the WHO pulling together and the international community working together, is very, very important to us.
All right, Maurice Payne, thank you very much for joining AM this morning.
Thanks very much, Kim.
And that is the Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne. Well, strict physical distancing restrictions are starting to be wound back across parts of Australia as the number of coronavirus cases continues to fall. People living in the Northern Territory and New South Wales will have a little bit more freedom from today. National Cabinet is also meeting to discuss what lies ahead in the weeks and months to come. Well, for more, I'm joined by political reporter Stephanie Boris. Steph, the number of new coronavirus cases remains low, so how is that expected to influence today's national Cabinet meeting? What are we expecting?
Good morning, Kim. Well, we're expecting to hear about further changes to the restrictions that are currently in place across Australia, particularly in areas such as sport, due to, as you mentioned, that reduction in the number of new cases of coronavirus. So as of this morning, Australia has recorded a total of 6,762 cases of coronavirus. 92 people have died. It is important to note, though, that of that figure, 6,762, the majority of people have recovered. So there's actually only about just over 1,000 active cases of coronavirus in Australia at the moment. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Paul Kelly, this morning saying that it's very positive signs. There's less than 100 new cases across Australia this week. However, he made it very clear that this is a marathon and authorities need to remain vigilant, as do Australians. But due to these promising figures, National Cabinet is looking at this path forward. So today they're specifically looking at finalising what's known as this Response Pandemic Intelligence Plan. In simple terms, it means looking at how to ensure that testing maintains at a high level and that more people sign up to that COVID Safe app so medical experts can keep watch and track of how many people have coronavirus and try and shut down any outbreaks. The National Cabinet will also look at devising this plan for how community and professional sport can resume safely, and they'll also discuss a code of conduct for the aged care sector amid reports that relatives have actually been banned from seeing their loved ones.
So, Steph, ahead of any major national changes being announced, some states and territories are already easing restrictions.
That's right, Kim, and that's due to the different numbers depending on where you live. So, for example, in New South Wales, from today, up to two adults and their children can visit another household. In the Northern Territory, that seems to be the place to be because playgrounds, pools, parks, outdoor religious gatherings, including weddings and funerals, will be allowed from today, and Territorians in the Northern Territory have been told but from the 15th of May, cafes, pubs, beauticians and galleries could open if the cases remain low and at zero. In Queensland from tomorrow, you can go for a drive within 50 k's of your home, and here in the ACT, we are technically coronavirus free, and suggestions have been made that the gathering restrictions that are at two people at the moment could be lifted to 10 within days.
Well, there are still a few hotspots, though, and there's been a bit of sad news out of New South Wales this morning.
Yeah, Kim, another resident has died at the aged care facility Newmarch House in Sydney's west, and this brings the number of people that have died to 13 at Newmarch House. On top of that, further testing has uncovered that another three residents do have coronavirus. The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, has been out speaking this morning, and she's been heavily critical of the way that Anglicare, that runs this facility, has handled this situation.
You do notice a difference in the way people who run these aged care homes across the nation are dealing with the issue. Some are doing it better than others, and unfortunately, this particular operator has been left wanting on a number of levels.
And Kim, just finally, news out this morning that five defence members have tested positive to coronavirus while serving in the Middle East. They are now back in Australia and are receiving adequate care.
That's our political reporter, Stephanie Boris. Thank you. Well, in the UK, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson is rejecting criticism that his government acted too slowly about a lockdown, even as the coronavirus death toll surges to almost 27,000. The British PM has fronted his first COVID-19 update since he fell ill with the virus himself 5 weeks ago. Here's our Europe correspondent, Samantha Hawley.
I'm sorry not to have been part of this trio for so long.
After a five-week health battle of his own, Boris Johnson fronted the daily press briefing once again.
Families every day are continuing to lose loved ones before their time. We grieve for them and with them.
The daily update sent the toll to 26,711 deaths. But the nation, Boris Johnson insists, is through the worst. For the first time, the virus has passed its peak.
Or rather, we've come under what could have been a vast peak, as though we've been going through some huge alpine tunnel. And we can now see the sunlight and the pasture ahead of us.
But still, lockdown measures will stay for now.
What you're going to get next week is really a roadmap, a menu of options. The dates and times of each individual measure will be very much driven by where we are in the epidemic.
It was a defiant Mr. Johnson who rejected criticism that missteps in the early days had led to the high death toll.
We avoided an uncontrollable and catastrophic epidemic where the reasonable worst case scenario was 500,000 deaths. But I do think that, broadly speaking, we did the right thing at the right time.
On the numbers, the UK is clearly tracking to be the worst nation in Europe. But Boris Johnson says that can't be judged now.
Actually, I think that the only real test, any real comparator is going, the comparison is going to be possible at the end of the epidemic when you look at total excess death.
The government's chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vallance, agrees it's too early for international comparisons.
We're through the first phase of this. There is a very long way to run for every country in the world on this.
The infection rate in the UK is now, he says, between 0.6 and 0.9. In other words, one infected person passes the virus on to less than one person. Until a vaccine is found, it must be kept under one, or a second peak would inevitably come. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
And on AM, it's 17 minutes past 8. In an unlikely alliance, the Construction Union and the Peak Building Industry Lobby Group have joined forces to push for more social housing to be built. The CFMEU and Master Builders Australia want the National Cabinet to commit to a $10 billion social and affordable housing fund to stimulate the economy, keep builders in jobs, and provide housing for vulnerable Australians. Rachel Mealy reports.
They make for strange bedfellows, but the CFMEU and Master Builders say they can work together through the current crisis. Dave Noonan is the National Secretary of the Construction Division of the CFMEU.
And I think it's really important that we do cooperate where it's necessary. I think we've got a higher obligation to our members, to the construction industry and to the nation than to continue to just throw mud at each other.
Danita Warne is the CEO of Master Builders Australia.
In late March, Dave Noonan and I spoke and recognised that if we were going to have a vibrant, successful industry through the COVID crisis, we had to cease hostility and we needed to work constructively together.
What they're proposing is a $10 billion fund to build social and affordable housing.
What the industry wants to do, both employers, unions, workers in the industry, the subcontractors that work in our industry, is we want to make a contribution to the future.
Master Builders Australia says the road ahead looks bleak. It forecasts a 40% decline in forward contracts and it predicts new home building starts will decline by 25%. Danita Warne says the social housing project would keep the industry alive.
We're of the view that the investment is all about job creation. We employ 1.2 million people in this sector. A 40% decline in work would result in around about 400,000 people losing their jobs at a time when we want to have an economic recovery in this country.
The groups propose a three-way funding arrangement with contributions from state and federal governments as well as industry superfunds. Dave Noonan says members of the CFMEU would support moves to invest their superannuation in this way.
Yes, I think there is a demand amongst people in the construction industry to see not just their superannuation, but other financial institutions and superannuation funds investing in the industry and investing in a way which is sustainable, which provides stable returns, but most importantly, contributes to jobs, activity, apprenticeships in the industry, and puts roofs over the houses of Australians who need urgently need housing.
In fact, both Dave Noonan and Danita Warne sit on the board of CBUS, the Construction Industry Superfund.
We are certainly, as directors of that fund, strongly urging the investment team to look at the opportunities, and we think there is a great win-win opportunity here in which the CBUS can not only have some great investment opportunities, but also its members are actually getting employment.
Danita Warne, the CEO of Master Builders Australia, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. And in a statement, the Federal Housing Minister, Michael Sukkar, says the government will continue to work to ensure the housing construction industry emerges strongly from the current health crisis. Well, manufacturing is already taking a big hit, with a new report showing it's at its worst level since the global financial crisis more than a decade ago. The latest Performance of Manufacturing Index from the Australian Industry Group shows that every area is in distress, with sales, production and employment recording their biggest monthly fall in the gauge's 28-year history. AI Group Chief Executive Innes Willocks says easing the physical distancing restrictions is now critical, and he's speaking with our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
The impact is really quite devastating. We've seen the biggest ever fall in the manufacturing index that we have been producing since 1992. And that tells us just how brutal and swift the economic decline and devastation has been.
Businesses are stressed, customers aren't spending, the outlook is very grim. What industries are hurting the most?
The only area of manufacturing to expand in April was the chemical component of manufacturing, and that's the bit of industry that produces cleaning products, detergents, sanitizers and the like. Everything else has fallen. So you look right through the paper industry, the metals manufacturing, wood manufacturing, textile manufacturing, right across the board, there has been declines.
You're also seeing a lot of big customers and also small customers outright cancelling their orders. What impact does that make on the planning of industry?
Well, what this is telling us with stories of companies now saying they have nothing in the pipeline and they've had orders cancelled. And if you don't have new orders, that tells us that quite clearly your order book is empty, and the prospects for the months ahead are pretty grim. And what this sort of data tells us is that we are going to see continuing difficult impacts on employment.
The ANZ Chief Executive Shane Elliott says it could take between 3 and 5 years for full employment to return. Does that sound about right?
Well, everyone's gazing into crystal balls here, but I have to say we are looking in terms of years before we rebuild the capacity that we have lost as very quickly as a result of this pandemic.
Now, this is primarily a health crisis and the economic lockdown has been necessary to contain the virus. But has it been worth the huge economic cost, given that the jobless rate is set to exceed 10%?
Well, this has been the great conundrum. It's health versus economics. But we are now paying the economic cost for the actions that had to be taken and were taken. There'll be essays written and thesis written for years about it, but the devastation is huge. Was it worth it? That's a balancing act, Peter.
Just on Australia's relationship with China and the Prime Minister's call for an inquiry into the genesis of the virus, as a former diplomat, do you see that there's a risk of a nasty ratcheting up in trade tensions?
I think we have to be realistic. Australia and China will never be best friends, but we can be friendly. But to have the Chinese ambassador making the bellicose statements that he did about Australia is quite frankly laughable and does him no credit. And to have Chinese envoys invited onto the stage with Australian ministers is sadly opportunistic.
Innes Willocks, Chief Executive of the Australian Industry Group, speaking with Peter Ryan. As states and territories start relaxing some of the restrictions put in place to curb the spread of coronavirus, there are concerns that demand for domestic violence support will soon surge. That's because some people simply haven't been able to seek help over the last 6 weeks. Here's political reporter Matthew Doran.
We've heard all the jokes and the moaning about how our lives have changed as we've been confined to our homes. The commute from bedroom to the office counted in steps rather than kilometres. The boredom arising from not being able to see our friends propping up the bar at the local pub. But those problems fade into insignificance when you stop and imagine just how difficult life has been for Australians cooped up in homes where they don't feel safe.
Restrictions on movement in particular, while absolutely necessary from a public health perspective, can also really increase pressures within the home environment.
Rebecca O'Connor is the chief executive of DV Connect in Queensland, which tries to coordinate domestic, family and sexual violence support services in the state.
While isolation is not an uncommon tactic of violence, whole communities in lockdown, that disrupt a vital lifeline to those living with domestic abuse.
Alison McDonald is the acting chief executive of Domestic Violence Victoria.
We know from international evidence that there are spikes in family violence in post-emergency and post-crisis situations. We know that from Australian experience with bushfires, with floods and with cyclones.
The federal government has released data showing an increase of around 11% in calls to the 1800 Respect helpline so far, not including frequent callers to the service. Men's Line, which specifically caters for men struggling with emotional health and relationship concerns, has also seen an increase in calls. But the most concerning statistic comes from Google data, with a 75% increase in searches about family and domestic violence compared to the average over the previous 5 years. Alison McDonald says the coronavirus crisis has already prompted a dramatic shift in how support centres operate.
It is tricky and services have been quite extraordinary in terms of moving their work to remote and online and telephone-based platforms.
Federal Social Services Minister Anne Rustin told AM the government committed $150 million in March to domestic violence support services so that they could meet the potential increase in demand. She said the priority was to ensure those experiencing family and domestic violence could access support as quickly as possible, whether isolation is still in place or as the nation comes out of it.
Matthew Doran reporting. Well, the arrival of COVID-19 has forced a major overhaul of how healthcare is delivered in Australia. Appointments by telehealth have skyrocketed and electronic prescriptions are becoming pretty common. At the same time, the country's first virtual hospital has quietly started operating. Penny Timms has more. Fingers wrapped around my
neck like noose of a rope. It's not how Dina Lynch, who goes by the stage name Jaguar Jones, thought she'd be launching her first EP. Rather than a glitzy party, the Aussie singer-songwriter was in an ambulance on her way to hospital as she fought off COVID-19.
The paramedics were so kind and pumped it through the car system, the van system, and so we celebrated the EP in the ambulance.
Dina Lynch was a patient of Australia's first virtual hospital run by a specialist unit at Sydney's Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, known as RPA Virtual. Patients have daily telehealth appointments and are issued with wearable devices to monitor their temperature and vital signs. The data is sent via Bluetooth to the patient's mobile and observed remotely by a team of nurses and doctors.
I didn't call the ambulance because I didn't want to stress a system that's already overloaded. So for them to make that call that was necessary for me, I think this is a really good alternative solution to get the right level of care we need for those suffering from COVID-19.
After a brief stay, she continued her recovery at home as a patient of the virtual hospital. RPA Virtual was launched in February to treat patients with conditions like cystic fibrosis, but it was overhauled to include people with COVID-19. Ideally, patients are treated at home or, if that isn't possible, in a hospital hotel serviced by New South Wales Health. Dr. Owen Hutchings is the clinical director of RPA Virtual.
The clear and most significantly obvious advantage for the virtual hospital model is that it prevents exposure of people to each other, so both healthcare workers to patients and patients to healthcare workers, but still provide excellent level care through the virtual modality.
That could be helpful during bad flu seasons and other infectious outbreaks. Aaron Jones is the Chief Nursing and Midwifery Information Officer at Sydney Local Health District, and he says there's scope for healthcare to be revamped.
This entire pandemic has presented some opportunities for us to actually leverage off technology to connect to our patients in our community in ways that we've never been able to do before.
Health economist Stephen Duckett from the Grattan Institute agrees.
There's been a change in a number of areas, electronic prescribing, for example, and
transmission of the prescription to the pharmacist. So there's change in the way we're operating, and also the change in the role of staff. So nurses are doing more now than they were doing prior to the pandemic. And so there's a whole lot of things which are good for the system and good for patients that we really need to be making sure is part of the new normal.
Dr. Stephen Duckett from the Grattan Institute, ending that report by Penny Timms. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. We're seeing glimpses of the other side of this now, with 5,500 Australian COVID-19 patients now recovered. But are those people any safer from infection than the rest of us?
Today on The Signal, we're looking into immunity to COVID-19 and finding out what we know already, what we don't know yet, and what it all means for the return to normal life. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.